Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs we're going to be talking with Ian McGarty, special guest from Silver Blade Publishing. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Tell us just a little bit about what Silver Blade has done recently that you've been working on.
So our last Kickstarter was Creeping Cold, which was a murder mystery adventure, really. It's sort of people have described it as The Hateful Eight meets The Thing, which I was completely pleased with as a description because that sounds awesome to me. But it was, you know, sort of murder mystery, building tension, a lot of fun, and that did pretty well on Kickstarter. The next thing we're working towards is truly sort of a sequel to that, but it's a large hex crawl adventure at the source of the curse that they explored last time. So it's, you know, big map, lots of fun things to do. It could turn into months and months of play, or you could just streamline straight to the throat of the adventure and finish it if you wanted to. But interesting and fun that we'll be playtesting that at TotalCon. I think I'm running it every morning, 8 to noon, so that the red eye game slot, I guess you'd say, right?
That sounds awesome. But, Ian. Now, just for our viewers' sake, those are all available in both Swords and Wizardry and 5th edition versions, correct?
That is true.
Excellent.
That is true.
So we wanted to have Ian on today specifically to talk about self-publishing for D&D and other RPGs here in 2020. And all three of us, actually, Paul, Ian, and myself, self-published for D&D, kind of on different online venues, as a matter of fact. So my products are on Lulu. Paul uses DM's Guild recently, and Ian's products are all on DriveThruRPG. So let's talk about editioning. So Ian, you like myself and Paul are traditionally an old school gamer. And I think you run a lot of your own personal games with Swords and Wizardry by Matt Finn,
right? Yeah, so I played a lot of Swords and Wizardry. My partner, Rocky, is only Swords and Wizardry.
Okay.
You know, he very rarely steps into any other edition because that's just the one that, after he got Pathfinder'd out and wanted something simple, fast, and he could chew your character up, and 2 minutes later, you'd be at the table again.
Yep, and that's very similar to the trajectory that I was on coming off third edition and going back to mostly original D&D stuff. So I think that the early Silver Belay products were all just Swords and Wizardry, right?
And so
it's the Creeping Cold product that for the first time you've got a Swords and Wizardry version and a fifth edition version, right?
Yeah, and they're actually fairly different. Like the main story is the same.
Okay.
But we wrote content for the Swords and Wizardry one that is not in the fifth edition one. So some stuff I really love in the Swords and Wizardry one is all the weapons have like a little ballad or story or legend, any magic item. So you could insert that into your game as just some rich flavor and tell you a little bit of what it does and some of the history of it. And so that was stuff we got to add in the Swords and Wizardry, but we just didn't have the space in the 5e.
Yeah, is that? I was going to ask if that was because of page count, just because the 5th edition stat blocks take up so much space, I assume.
Oh, they do. And we were like, ooh, suddenly we had extra space to put stuff in, and where we'd been trying to trim stuff out, it was kind of nice to be able to squeeze more creative, fun stuff in there.
Interesting.
Yeah, I kind of experienced something very similar. So my product, The Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood, started life as a little freebie I wrote on my blog. And it was, targeting OD&D, and it was written in a very sort of one-page dungeon minimalist way. So it actually took two whole pages of printed text when I was done. When I expanded that out to 5th edition, now I added a bunch of stuff. So it definitely is a meatier adventure. in fifth edition, but it jumped to 20 pages, and a lot of those pages are custom monster stats, and yeah, I'm not surprised.
And it's not just the monster stats that people forget, it's the skills. Like, you have to add all of that text about how to use the skills and still make it work.
Yeah, that's true. I think I remember doing that for traps, right? Like, anytime I had a trap, I'm like, okay, well, this is the skill you roll to detect it, and this is the skill you roll to disarm it, and here's what could happen if it goes off. And yeah, it's just a lot more words.
Do you actually have that in the text? Do you actually have that in the text paragraphs, or can you remove that to isolated addition stat sections?
It's in the text paragraph. So the first one, the Undying Orbs one that we had done,
right.
We're like, we're going to put this into fifth edition. And we had sat down with it and it was just like, no, it's way too much work to jump Swords and Wizardry to fifth edition. It was overwhelming.
Okay.
So we just kind of said, well, it won't be this one.
Interesting.
And waited. And then, so what we did actually was write Creeping Cold in fifth edition. And then we transfer to Swords and Wizardry and use all that extra space usually to add some goodies.
Interesting. So you never actually, you weren't playing a version in Swords and Wizardry first or anything like that?
So Creeping Cold, Rocky only ran in Swords and Wizardry, but he would literally run it from the fifth edition version and then just, it's crunch every stat block down to the one text line that you need.
Yeah, I gotta imagine running on the fly. It's a little easier to on the fly downgrade from fifth to Swords and Wizardry, right? Just because it's just easier to keep the stuff in your head,
right? You're like hit dice, hit points, armor class, and any special attacks. All right, we're good to go.
Yeah,
it's interesting because that's actually not what I expected. Because I guess I'm accustomed to Bill Webb's Rap and Athic that or something like that that originally was an old school. D&D product, and then that I think I got the impression that there was more freedom in the old school version that you could have traps that lop off an arm or something like that that isn't normally a fifth edition mechanic, and then you had to get creative about how do you put that stuff in fifth edition. So that's are you comfortable with that writing fifth edition first now?
I am. So my regular Friday game is now pretty much fifth edition that everybody has pushed along. We have some younger players and I honestly, I literally will play anything. I could care less what edition it is or what game it is. I like playing games. So be it, Paranoia or West End Game Star Wars, I'm in.
Yeah.
But
cool.
And fifth is a decent system. It's pretty elegant.
I agree. I mean, I've played a number of sessions in it, totally legitimate. It's funny because I feel like possibly in the future there's an outside chance that Paul and I might go on the same trajectory that you're talking about of maybe one of us running a fifth edition version, one of us running an old school version of the same adventure at some point.
And it's been great at cons where we do that, where we're running the same thing but in different editions, and it turns into a different game. Which is interesting. It's fun.
I'm laughing because I just suggested this to Paul a couple of days ago that we do exactly what you just said.
It's a blast to see too, because it's interesting to tease out, and you find stuff that one edition misses, and hopefully you can find a common ground where you can maybe include some of the things that went really well from, Swords and Wizardry version into a fifth edition version. And how do you do that?
Yeah, if I could sort of jump us a little bit here, we touched a little bit on how you're going to be running this stuff at upcoming at TotalCon. Conventions are actually, of course, how we met, right? We Dan and I got to play with Ian, I think, first at GaryCon and then at TotalCon again.
Yep.
Is that largely how you're playtesting your stuff, through convention play?
So convention play is the final tip of the iceberg of playtesting for us. So I play it through... I'm lucky enough to have a group of kids that I play with, because I'm a speech pathologist, so I run a game for a bunch of kids in a lockdown facility that are, if anybody's going to break it, they're going to break it. And then I also run some other games too that in its constant play testing of it. So, but by the time you get it, I mean, Creeping Cold, I'd probably run that you know, 60 times before we were like, all right, it's ready to roll, it's ready to publish.
Did you say six? Was that 6-0? Was that 1-6-0?
Yeah, it was a lot.
Crap.
And then I still felt like I needed, when we were like, all right, it's perfect, it's laid out, I was like, well, let's play test it one more time. But that one was particularly hard because it was so NPC heavy. Like, you really, you want someone to understand the NPCs, understand what's going on. It wasn't a linear dungeon crawl, which I think, you know, requires a little less playtesting. You know, the questions you're asking are, did I murder everybody in the first room? But yes. Okay, I need to tweak some things.
Fascinating.
But that was, that's one of the things that actually teased out that, like, a lot of the skill checks we do in 5th edition are sort of tiered. Mm-hmm. So you get a 10, you're going to get something. If you get a 14, you're going to get a little bit more. If you get an 18, you're going to get even more. So it, you know, it, so that you're never left with nothing. That was important, finding those, because I think a lot of the mistakes towards 5th edition is that people skill wall the necessary components to finishing your adventure. So like, if you can't ever hit the skill number, you're never going to figure it out.
That's sort of like the classic dungeon crawl problem of secret doors, right? Like if half your dungeon is behind a secret door and they just don't find it, I guess you don't run that
out of luck.
I can see that, and that's very, I can see that in a murder mystery type adventure, that you're being very analogous to that.
Yeah, and that adventure too, like, it moves along. There are scripted events that happen at certain times, and, you know, there were parties we ran through that are like, what is happening? We don't, like, they were just more terrified and confused as it went on. Whereas other groups were investigating pretty hard and, like, they had an idea about what was happening and were watching the people when things happened.
Now, are you expecting that the play duration of your game is sort of congruent to a traditional 4-hour convention time slot? Or did you have to, like, scale it back to run it at conventions?
No. So Creeping Cold, I would run, you can really only run, and running it fast, you can run maybe a third of it. So I always ask people if they want to do the intro. Do you want to get to and, like, start to see it unfold? Have a couple fights and interact with some NPCs. Do you want to see the culmination? So I sort of let them pick, like, beginning or end.
Yeah.
Do you want the alpha, the omega of this game? Usually they pick the end, but that's great. It's because it's a lot of fun.
Cool.
I had one group that they messed with a random encounter Trant, and they 5th edition, the guy that got crushed, like, shot it with a something stupid, some warlock power, blasted it once, and all right, well, game over.
Interesting. Yeah, when I was
go ahead, Paul.
Sorry. I think we had a little network hiccup there, just as we were all trying to talk. I was just going to say, when I was doing Vile Crypt, it was originally written for a group. It's really targeting, like, a good, you know, 10, 12 hours of play. So when I thought, oh, I should really be running this at conventions, both to play test and to promote it, I really had to, like, look at it and go, what piece can I chop out of this thing? Now, fortunately, in that adventure, there is actually, like, a couple of rooms that lead up to a not quite climax, right? Like, something that feels like maybe it's the end, and then you realize, oh, no, there's so much more. And I thought that's a nice, again, that's now my advertiser hat is on and going, oh, now they're going to go buy the module so they can play the rest.
Yeah, and I historically always struggle with this, like, take a campaign module and how do I fit it into a 4-hour convention setting. So those are actually pretty interesting strategies to use, because that's something I continually bang my head against, actually.
And the Dirge of the Frostjarl, which is what we're doing now, is it's made for this because it's a hex crawl. So I've just selected some of my favorite places, and, you know, it's like, how hard do you want this to be? Do you want to have one survivor or everybody survives? Where do you want to go? So I think that's, you know, it's give them a menu and see what they can get to, which is fun.
Interesting.
So both you and Rocky are probably running this at conventions, right? At that point, when you come back from that, how have you come up with, like, a format for comparing notes, or is it just a free for all? Like, how'd it go for you?
So we a lot of it, like, we take pretty good notes when we're actually running, because that's where you get your changes from.
Right.
But he and I, like, he lives in Michigan and I live in New Hampshire, so we're quite far away. We actually get quite a bit of writing and outlining done at conventions. So, like, that's where we'll have an outline for our next product and we'll have everything ready to roll and sort of have a game plan devised. Like, this is what you're going to start moving on. This is what I'm going to start moving on. So it's like our quarterly business meeting, I guess.
That's awesome.
Great. That's funny because we get, I mean, it's interesting because the last time Paul and I were together at a con, we similarly had this like kind of creative like burst of energy together that we came up with a couple of ideas for projects. So that's very reminiscent.
And that's, well, that, and that's what Creeping Cold was actually Total Con. I was like, hey, I've got an adventure idea. Let me pitch it to you. And we sat down and we, like, together at like 11 at night, you know, for 3 hours, we typed like a dozen pages. We were like, holy crap, we just finished a huge part of this adventure. This is going to work. So
William is asking about common pitfalls that newbies to publishing might drop into. And I think that might be a good way for us to start to tackle sort of the differences between some of the different places where you can publish. I know, Ian, you and I talked a lot about the legal differences between Drive-Thru and DM's Guild and sort of the agreement you have to sign, which I know actually on DM's Guild it's quite restrictive and has scared quite a few people away.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing is intellectual property. Yep. And what do you own?
Yep.
So none of us are lawyers, so you know, take this grain of salt.
Yeah.
But game systems and mechanics cannot be copywritten. So they're, because you can't change them. It's like the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So, you know, it has to be that way to function. But IP is not. So, I mean, DM's Guild is awesome. If I really wanted to write in the Forgotten Realms, I would do DM's Guild in a heartbeat because you can use all those characters you know and love. Whereas if you're creating original material, sometimes I think it's you're better off going the other way with just regular one bookshelf drive through RPG. Because you're retaining that control, that power,
right?
And you know, what you created, you own.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're obliquely referring to here is there is a clause there in the agreement that you sign at DM's Guild that says that you cannot sell that product anywhere else. Once it's on DM's Guild forevermore, it can only be sold on DM's Guild. And Dan and I were actually having a conversation recently about would it be possible to take the Vile Crypt, which is a 5th edition adventure on DM's Guild, and make an old school version of it for sale somewhere else. And I'm not sure, to be honest. I kind of suspect maybe no is the answer. And it's at least gray enough that I'm pretty nervous about it.
Yeah, I would lean towards no. That makes me feel anxious just hearing it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons publishers like us have stayed away from DM's Guild. And a bunch of other publishers that we know too, because that's a concern. If you want another edition, you can't do it. You can't print as well, so they limit, like, only the people they pick will be printed as something. So you know, if your adventure module sold 3,000 drive-through RPG copies, and you're like, well, shoot, people would love a physical copy of this, you're out of luck on DM's Guild.
Now you can do 5th edition stuff on Drive-Thru, right? But then you're limited to just what's in the Open Gaming License.
Yeah. And you can always refer to any version of the Open Gaming License you prefer. So I think it's something else that publishers forget. But you do not have to accept the newest version. You can jump to any version that's been written.
For example, just to give William some concrete advice here, I think like one of the things I've heard is, like, don't, if you're writing 5th edition material, don't include the stat block for goblins. Just say, there are goblins here, right? And then, and I'm not even sure if you can say, and they can be found on page 207 of the Monster Manual. Don't know if that's the right page number, I just made that up. But I think you just got to say goblins and let the user find the stats themselves.
Yeah, and you could put just the stats block in with the numbers, but you can't put any of their flavor text description.
Right, so like at that point, you're like essentially making up your own creature, right? That's a... Now I'm not using the IP anymore, right?
Yeah, once you reskin a creature, which is common for most publishers. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing it since I was, you know, 11 years old playing Dungeons & Dragons. You're like, you just give it a different name, and no, it's got ice instead of fire, and So I think reskinning things is common practice. Yeah,
for sure.
I was reading your blog article on reskinning trolls from last year, of all the different versions of trolls that you've made in different games, like that way.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's a lot of my custom monsters in the Vile Crypt are, A, they're gnolls, B, they're undead, C, they have Egyptian themes. But ultimately, under the covers, I would start with some other monster and go, okay, they're kind of like this other monster, and then let me try to apply undead gnoll Egyptian to it, and then and you'll see where I ended up.
I really like the undead gnolls. I got such a kick. There are points reading that I like was giggling because I'm like, oh, this would be great.
I was very surprised to discover, and here's another point of like, you probably want to include art in your adventure. So please, if you're new to this, don't just go Google image search and shove art into your doc. Like, that's definitely not legal. You need to make sure that you have the rights to publish that artwork. So there are some sites where you can get available for commercial use stock art. I've used Pixabay. Drive-Thru itself sells some. You can buy artwork through Drive-Thru.
And you can buy some pretty inexpensive stock art. Like, I'd push, if you're looking to publish something and you're like written, you want some art, check out guys like J.E. Shields, who has a beautiful and extensive stock art library. And extensive enough that you could probably use stuff that other people either have minimally used or haven't. But there's a bunch of people out there. Hershey, what is it? Blanket. There's a whole slew. I can give you a list too, that there's great stuff to do. But I mean, pitfalls of the publishing truly are, how much money of your own are you going to spend? Which is something we've all talked about in the past. And at some point, like, we initially were spending money, but our goal was a zero-sum game so that I didn't pay for any art. And that's sort of what we turn our profits into now, is art's your biggest expense. Art and layout, if you can't do the layout yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I spent about $20 on art in the Vile Crypt. I had a fair amount of free stock art. And then I really lucked out when I went on to Drive-Thru and searched for stock art that was, I think I just used the keywords gnoll and undead and was shocked at how many came up. I actually heard some advice about maybe doing the inverse of, like, go cruise around, find some cool stock art before you come up with your idea for your adventure. See if you can hook your adventure idea into the stock art you find. Might be easier than the other way around.
We should do a publishing challenge for that, like a 5-page adventure. That would be interesting.
Yeah, and I have a couple of friends that are artists that we've talked doing the same thing of like, hey, that's a really cool piece, could I use that in an adventure? And they say yes, and then I think about writing something around that. The other thing I'll point out is somebody on Twitter this morning noted that the Paris Museum just made digitally available like 100,000 works in their archive, which is all in the public domain.
Oh, wow.
And I've done that kind of thing like in Book of War in the past. Obviously, the vast majority of something like that is not going to be fantasy specific, but, you know, maybe you can, you know, pick through like the medieval era type stuff. And I've done that in the past sometimes.
Yeah.
And that was like Creeping Cold. We used photos because we wanted the NPCs to seem real. So that was like a calculated decision about doing that. But then once again, like, we're searching for photos of like a Viking looking guy or a hairy merchant or whatever.
Yep.
Right. Or you could certainly use portraits. Like, if you've got a giant stock of, you know, thousands of public domain portraits, you could certainly pick out stuff that works halfway decently for that.
Yeah, Wikimedia Commons is good for that. You can find a lot of classic art that's available for use like that. There was another site which I'm totally not remembering, but I did post to my blog, which is where all the artwork came for Insanity Cards. My Insanity Cards are all artwork that was originally promotional material, like posters and whatnot, for a hypnotist's show in the Victorian period.
That's amazing.
I found that one. I was like, this is amazing. And there was like, I don't know, 6 or 8 pieces of artwork, like full spread artwork of people doing really crazy things. Victorian like people doing crazy things. I was like, this is perfect.
Monsieur Flambeau. You're like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
Nice, nice. I've also gone into museums and surreptitiously taken photos of paintings that I really like, which may possibly run me afoul of at least two separate issues. But I've actually done that too.
Funny.
Anyway, kids, don't do that.
Yeah, that is not advocated. I don't.
Opinions expressed by any individual in this program are not necessarily espoused by everybody else.
But for maps, for me, I just got good enough making maps to be able to do it. Yeah. But that was because we were the first one we did, we bought a map for $75, I think. And we were like, wow, this is really expensive.
Yeah.
And so I just started making better maps. I took about a year and a half really just pushing and studying to make the maps. And now, I guess they're decent. I've been paid by other people for them. So I guess that makes me.
Yeah, I think we have some artwork to show. This is, seems like a
good, I guess that makes me sort of professional.
Show some artwork. These are the covers of Creeping Cold, which is available now on DriveThruRPG. I'm just gonna. I don't know what we're gonna see here, so I'm just gonna advance forward. Ian, you can tell us.
Feel free. I can give you a running playbook. Yeah, so there's the Creeping Cold. This is from Dirge of the Frostjarl. So this is by Keelan Haverson, who you can find at Wonky Art, W-O-N-K-E-E, Art. And we gave him some art direction on this, and it's gross and terrifying, and it was exactly what we were looking for.
That's awesome. If I can ask, so did you pay him a fee to make that, or is he getting a royalty, or how'd you get that art?
So this was a commissioned piece with full commercial rights.
Okay.
So basically the way that our contract works, too, is that that person, Keelan, can sell prints of it, can make money off it. He could stick it on a T-shirt.
Yep.
He can use it to make him to give himself a living, but he can't let anybody else commercially use it. That's otherwise owned ours. He could sell the original if he wants.
And you,
because I mean, ideally, that's what we want. I'd love it if someone saw this in our piece and was like, "I love it," and then bought the original from Keelan. You know, that'd be amazing.
Yeah,
because that's what you want. Is every creative to be in here. Frankly, these aren't money-making industries. We want everybody to get a little bit better and to get something from
it. That was then an out-of-pocket expense for you up front for making this new work.
That was a Creeping Cold profits expense.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
That's what
gotcha.
So
let me just say something. So that's very, I mean, that terrifies me, and I'm very sensitive. It's slightly reminiscent of the character in the Gravity Falls cartoon. Have I got that right?
Yeah, like the end. Yes.
What's his name? What's that character's name?
Yeah, with Dollar Bill or something like that.
Yeah, Bill. Right. I think so. Right. Was that on your mind when you gave that direction for that piece?
It wasn't, and it's how he turned it out. But because this was, I mean, this is supposed to be some sort of strange eldritch horror, and I was like, I just want it to make me feel sick to my stomach with some of the stuff we said to him, and he nailed it. It's awful.
I agree. Terrifying. It's like Bill, but 100 times worse.
Yeah, it's like Bill, not as a cartoon.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well done all around.
All right.
Let me just say, as a game designer, you know, one of the very best things is to have an idea, send the idea out to an artist, and then get, you know, an illustration or a picture back is one of the most exciting things about that, of seeing somebody else's take in a different media on the ideas that I had. And I just, if you do have that opportunity, that's one of my favorite things about game design, actually.
It's interesting because, I mean, an art direction is a skill that I think that is often overlooked by publishers, but you have to be able to, you know, provide an accurate description and get what you want, because the artist doesn't have time after time to be redoing what you're asking for.
Oh yeah.
And you have to find artists that you trust and you know, can take this word vision that you've given them and make something like that, which, I mean, that one was dead on. That's what we wanted. And I never could have pictured it in its final form, but there you go. Keelan is a visual artist. Good.
Right. And I would say, I mean, maybe I've had the good fortune of working with really, really great artists in the past, is that when they, you know, let them be excited about it. So like when, if they come back and there's some part of it that you hadn't considered, like all of that's happy accidents. And, you know, now let that be your vision for the product, because that's so much better than you go. Like, I've personally never asked anybody to redo something, because I think that just kind of poisons the whole well when you do that. So if you are surprised, take that as a good thing if you do get that back in the art.
It definitely can. I have a couple more that he did for this that I should show you, because they're amazing. And I know he's been like, I want to promote them. But here's one that this was my favorite monster from. I'll see if Paul can get that.
Yeah, sorry, it's going to take me a moment.
Yeah. But I just sent him two. So if Keelan did this one of the Black Hawthorn tree, which is sort of our fast travel method for this island, once you figure out how to use it. And then the other one is, I think it's possibly my favorite piece of art favorite monster encounter of all time, which is, so that's the Black Hawthorn one that we'll see coming up. And then this one right here is,
nice.
This is my, I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I'm, but this is insane. Like, a cockatrice is not terrifying, right? Like, no, we're all like, cockatrice, whatever. It's a low hit dice. By the time it's terrifying enough, it's too weak to actually threaten your party. So I thought, why not have a flock of cockatrice? And it's true, this encounter that builds and ramps, and it's like, it's terrifying for the players. Like, usually half of them are petrified or beat up, and the wizard has started to fly to escape. But it's a fun encounter. And that's sort of an overland encounter that we've left on our island, so it just continues to travel, like, in a straight line.
Nice.
So you as the DM can, you know, give it a day, a hex, and then, like, oh, here it is again.
Interesting.
I apologize to the artist here. I'm noticing I think it is a little squashed in our display here because of whatever it is I've done to set this up. So my apologies.
Not an aspect ratio.
Yeah.
I will say to add something to what Ian's saying, like, personally, I'm always terrified by cockatrices. And when we ran into them in Paul's game, that was the moment where everybody says that I spazzed out while we were playing last year. But that having, my players are pretty terrified of cockatrices. But that having been said, in a game I ran last year, I had a wilderness encounter that was rumored to be giant birds, probably rocks, but it turned out to be a flock of rock-sized cockatrices when they got there. So that went that went very sideways on the players.
Yeah, that's terrible.
What's this piece we're looking at,
yeah,
Ian?
And really fun too, as an advisor, just like, so this is a Black Hawthorn tree, and that's why this was another one of Keelan's that he did. It's pretty neat. So kind of a fairy tree,
nice,
that you can make offerings at, and if you unlock its secrets, you can use it to teleport around the island, which is helpful.
Awesome.
And why don't we look at the map that?
Yeah. Now I've made it crazy here by trying to get those images in last minute. But there you go.
Yeah, and this is by Glenn Seal. This is so I've doctored this one just with this. So this is all our total. If you're playing at TotalCon, take a look at this, and you can choose from the white selections of different encounter locations of what sounds fun.
Awesome.
Lots of different places and lots of fun.
Oh no. I really ruined it.
So that's one of the locations there.
Great.
That one is, that's my arc.
Great.
So. Yeah, that's what you were talking about, of sort of just upping your own art, map making skills. What are you using to make your maps in, Ian?
So I hand draw. And then I move to Photoshop, and I do like a gazillion different layers and adding it. I don't color all of them. This was one of my earlier attempts at coloring. I'm terribly colorblind, red-green colorblind, so sometimes the coloring is like a mechanical thing for me where I'm lowering numbers rather than me truly seeing it. Like this one, I don't think I see correctly, but people have said it looks nice, so I just believe them.
Wow, it is. That must be tough.
Sorry.
But I'm a very, I've always been a fan of the classic, like, mod, you know, blue and white module maps that are in there, and I pump those out like crazy. I love those.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I know, like, there's a lot of artists out there, I think especially like Dyson Logos, who's you know, just making lots and lots and lots of maps and constantly refining his style. But when you get down to it, like every time I sit down to draw maps and think about, like, okay, well, how can I improve my map and make it look nicer, make it look more artistic? I'm always like, you know, ultimately, it's just a lot of empty boxes. Most dungeon maps are just a bunch of empty boxes with numbers in them and connections. So there's not a ton to do, right?
Well, and I think that, like, stepping it up is what I learned, at least, is you've got to fill all the white space somehow or do something to break it up, or it does. It just looks, you're like,
right. So you're talking about, like, cross-hatching or little details with inside a room of, you know,
even
a
textures
here or shield there or whatever.
Let's see what I was doing. I was doing something this morning. Let's see what I got. But I do, and I'll draw the same stuff over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Until I feel like I've got it to where it wants to be.
I feel like that's a problem I always have when drawing maps, is that I sit down and I'm just like, yep, it's another bunch of interconnected boxes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like every other thing I've drawn before.
So, like, this is for that new one.
Yeah.
This is not finished, though. So this is where I scanned. So this was just scanned. I don't know if I'm... how good a picture I'm showing you.
Yeah, it's reasonable. Yeah.
But so I go from that to into Photoshop, and then I add even more detail.
Yep.
Or if I'm feeling courageous enough, attempt to start coloring. And but yeah, the point is to fill up all that white space so that you're not just left with these big holes.
Personally, I'm a cheap bastard, so I haven't even shelled out for Photoshop, and I just use GIMP, which is a free image editor. I recommend that for folks who don't want to shell out the cash for Photoshop.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
Same here. So maybe let's talk about, so as far as the publishing, let's talk about promoting it. So you know, Paul has been researching this recently, and we've been talking about that. Have you Kickstartered all the Silver Belay products, or just the last one?
So we just did the last one,
yeah,
and this upcoming one will be on Kickstarter, which we were slated to kickstart earlier, but then we're like, so we try not to compete with people we know too. Like, I don't want to, like, if Paul was kickstarting, I wouldn't want to start on the same day, just as sort of a courtesy.
Okay.
Because we like it, because if he's going to do something, and in regards to promotion, like, we're going to try to support each other, because it's an independent publishing network. You know, it's a bunch of small indie publishers, and, you know, we're all in this together. I don't care who you are. If you're doing it and you're struggling with that, we're here to help you. And I think that that's important. So we kind of are trying to push past that Christmas window now, and should hopefully be starting soon.
Were you happy with how the last one went?
Oh, yeah. It exceeded our... We didn't lose money.
Okay.
It exceeded our expectations. And we hit some stretch goals that people appeared to like, but didn't end up, you know, we didn't sell anybody a $200 Wizards Tower that we could never produce, kind of thing.
Okay.
So I think we avoided a lot of the pitfalls.
Yeah. What advice would you have for somebody who's never done a Kickstarter before, but is considering doing it? Like,
don't give additional, like, swaggy material other than dice. Dice are cheap to make and get. Go for dice if you're going to do anything, but don't offer custom minis. Don't you know, try not to do that stuff without really truly knowing the expense. So, like, one of ours was, like, we knew once we hit a certain amount of money that we could just pay for shipping out of that profits without losing money. So, like, that was a reasonable stretch goal for us. Like, why not just ship it to everybody? It's like one less hassle for them.
So free, free shipping was a stretch goal.
Yeah. Okay. So that was, but it was free continental U.S.
Right.
Shipping. So because gosh knows what happens when you get out of that.
Yeah.
But that was a stretch goal that we thought people would appreciate, and we could afford to do. I think that and being written when you kickstart. The other huge Kickstarter downfall is, you know, Dan and I have an idea. We make an outline together at TotalCon in a month, and then we start the Kickstarter. And it's like, it's not done. People don't realize that last 15%, 20% of the adventure or whatever you're writing is the hardest and slowest percent of it.
Mm.
You know, in my experience, like, that's the grind, is getting that, like, everything finally connected, making sure it's edited, and just getting over that last little hump. I think people often kickstart much before that and then are surprised when, you know, we're like Far West, we're waiting 7 years for it because he's, you know, got that last 20%.
Yeah. So you had it completely written before you started the Kickstarter?
We were actually laid out by the Kickstarter. Okay. So.
And you'd play tested it before that point and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Fascinating.
So, like, Dirge of the Frostjarl, like, I've been playtesting probably for about a year, the different encounters and stuff, and tweaking the encounters, which is funny, too. Some of my players who originally playtested with me are going to play at TotalCon, and they'll end up playing encounters that may seem similar, but they've evolved so much from the playtesting that they won't even recognize some of them, which is, that's why you playtest it.
Now, gotcha. When you do, gotcha. So when you're doing your Kickstarter and you're talking about print copies of your material, are you still going through print-on-demand services, or at that point are you trying to optimize by getting, you know, some kind of batch print run?
So we use a printer. So far we've only ever used a U.S.-based local printer, it's always local to Rocky in Michigan, because okay. He has a relationship with a printing company. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we will continue to do until it's, I don't foresee it happening for a while, but until we need 10,000 copies, we're not going to contact.
Let me echo David's question from the chat here. So what is a good first print run? Like 500, 1,000?
I don't want to be disheartening, but David, if you are just putting out a module, it's your first one, print 50.
Yeah,
and you'll have a couple extra for a while, and the goal is to break even, and that's what you should be looking at doing, is how many do I need to print to be able to, you know, buy myself a coffee after this and still survive. I think that if you print a lot, you'll be less left with a lot, and you can always print more. You still have, I mean, this is all digital. You still have the files. We could easily order a second print run of anything.
Well, and it's easier to go up too, right? Like, you could certainly, if your Kickstarter starts to take off and you have enough time, I assume you could contact your printer and say, hey, guess what? Instead of 50, we need 100 or 150 or whatever.
Yeah. It's going to affect timelines, which is, and we padded our timeline.
Yeah.
You know, it's that old contractor's adage, like, under promise and over deliver. So, you know, we were like, well, let's give ourselves an extra month just in case.
Yep.
And we didn't need it. And we were, you know, 2 months early delivering, but it's because we were ready for bad things to happen. Or whatever, a paper or an ink shortage in Michigan or, you know, whatever might actually affect that.
What do you do? Like, how do you sell the paper batch that you have? As opposed to, you know, people buying it on drive-through. Like, are you selling paper copies through a website beyond drive-through or at conventions or something like that?
So we've done some through, like, Facebook, our Facebook Silver Boulets Facebook page, that you can always, if you really want a physical copy, you can contact us and that's not a big deal. But we do a lot of convention sales. So, and we have some partners. So North Texas, I love that convention. It's very homey feeling. It's a lot of the original authors of many of these RPG games we love, but it still feels like you're in someone's giant living room. But we always sell there, and we've actually partnered with a bunch of other independent partners because I said, you know, I was like, well, I want to sell my stuff, and I got Skeeter Green and Levi Combs and Jim Wampler and, like, all these guys we knew who were doing this and said, all right, well, we got a table, and you can put your stuff out, and, you know, and we'll cash you out, and I can accept these forms of payment, and we'll make sure you get, you know, we'll square away at the end. But that's how we've done a lot of that. That and industry partners that we've worked with or done work for are often willing to, I mean, frankly, we're not going to sell dozens and dozens and dozens of copies. But many of those companies, if you're familiar with them and you talk to them, like, they'll throw half a dozen of your modules out there and, you know, sell a couple for you. Because for them, it's just more product to offer. And for you, it might be a sale or two.
I mean, I feel like it underscores really the value of the convention scene to a small publisher or to a self-publisher, right? Like, not only is it an opportunity to run your stuff for the sake of playtesting or for the sake of promotion, but there's also a networking angle to it, right? That really it is, there is a strong community amongst self-publishers, whether it's, be it on Twitter or Facebook or at conventions. And I think, as Ian points out, like, you know, we're not like, it's not like a cutthroat, I got to do better than Ian kind of thing, right? Like, we're all right, hoping to help each other out. It's a great community, I think, to engage with.
Yeah, I think when our Kickstarter was running, it was important to us to beat Skeeters, who had just run, and we beat him by like $40 or something. So that was just to kind of stick it to him a little bit, but
exactly.
But it's a healthy. I say that, and then I drew one of the maps in the module that he was Kickstarting. So, like, we just all help each other out. We know that's what you do. If you someone's doing this, like David is saying in that chat, that like it's a labor of love. Yeah. Someone's doing this because they're so excited about something, they want it out there. And, you know, like, listen, if I can help you in any way to do that, I will, if it's in my power.
It is ultimately, yeah, like, I don't know about you, but I find it just to be a fun activity. It's an engaging, interesting, satisfying thing to do. And I would recommend, I think, you know, if you're on your own, is go out there and see if you can find someone to collaborate with. Because, you know, as Dan was mentioning, like just working with an artist and, like, giving them direction and getting something back that surprises you is super fun. And, you know, it doesn't have to be art and writing, whatever it is, whatever your collaboration is. Collaborating with someone is, I think, really energizing, right? And some of these sites really enable it, right? Like, I don't know if you ever used, or you probably use this, I assume, Ian, but like on DriveThru, I know you can assign percentages of royalties to different accounts. So it's actually pretty easy to split up the proceeds and say, oh, great, you know, do all the art and we'll give you 5% of the royalties, and you can just set that up.
Yeah, and DriveThru will send them the tax stuff they need too if you hit them. So you guys are like Rocky and I, where you work in a partnership that many people aren't, and I don't know how they don't do it, because I feel like when I'm stuck, that Rocky is the impetus to keep me moving and like and to get my creativity back alive again.
I can totally see that. I you know what? It's interesting, those kinds of writing teams of, and two people's a really good number, actually. Like two people, it has a lot more strength than actually just one person, like you just said, coming to like a writer's block or something like that. And I've had good experiences in the past with a two person writing team. That makes sense.
So I think what David had another question too is about the
with such small sales, is 5e multiplier actually relevant?
And I had the same question, actually. So, you know, now that you've had the one product that has a Swords and Wizardry variant, Beller or not?
So just
sorry, we had a little network hiccup then. Can you repeat that question for our viewers?
Yeah, was the fifth edition variant like a lot better seller or not?
We're almost 10-1.
Wow. Okay.
And even just looking at straight downloads from our Kickstarter distribution for PDFs, it was 3-1 for downloads, and I think some people, like you or I, just download all of it and you're going to look at what you're going to look at. But the 5e market is alive. There are a lot of new players and us, like, so if we can. Personally, my goal is to attempt to double the number of 5e players we can get. Okay. And that will get people in. That will let them see our old school style, however we want to pitch whatever we're doing. They'll let us, you know, see some of the gaming that isn't just this beautiful commercial stuff, but is grittier and more exciting and I guess less commercial than some of the big name stuff. And that's the goal, is to increase our 5e numbers that way.
Interesting. Once upon a time, go ahead, Paul.
Sorry, there's an underlying thing I think that we're kind of dancing around, Ian, that I think both of you and I kind of agree on here, which is that your longer term goal has got to be to get a wide ranging portfolio, right? You want a lot of different products for a lot of different types of fans out there, and that they will help each other grow.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
That's why, like, your first thing that you put up there you know, don't expect it to just like shoot the moon and be this amazing thing, but it's a good first step. Get more stuff out. You know, I was at PAX Unplugged. I got to chat with Chris Tang of DriveThruRPG, and I was asking him like, "Oh, if I'm making 5e content, should I be looking at DriveThru or DM's Guild, which is better?" And he said, "Both. You should be on both. Like, put some content on DriveThru, put some content on DM's Guild, and cross promote them."
Yeah, and he's right. Like, I think that's important. And for us too, like, hopefully someone reads a 5e one and then picks up a Swords and Wizardry one and likes that streamlined, you know, like my character backstory will be created in the first year of play with this character rather than ahead of time.
Yep.
And that's fine. If like, hopefully they do. Like, there's, I own no license on what is right. I hope I put something out there that people love and have fun with.
Right. Now, you mentioned that the switch from 5th edition to Swords and Wizardry allowed you to add a whole bunch of extra content. Once upon a time, it was, and I'm thinking like the 3rd edition era, it was semi-common to write publications that had multi-stats. Like, you'd have an appendix in the same book, and you'd have D&D stats, and you'd have some other book stats. Does nobody do that anymore? Do you consider possibly that as an option?
That people aren't really doing that very often. There's a few people who've done it in the past 5 years, and their sales didn't show that it made a difference. I don't know if that's people, like, everybody was insulted because it had everybody else's stats in it, or what the case was with that. But we didn't see it doing that, and we actually got, because we kickstarted as a 5e product, and we got a little flack from some Swords and Wizardry people, like, "Well, you're going to do this as a Kickstarter, and then you're not even going to do the Swords and Wizardry." And we had put the Swords and Wizardry version as a stretch goal. Frankly, like, we were looking at the dollars and cents. It was brass tacks at that point for us. It was tough. We weren't trying to alienate the community, but I think that people in the community responded aptly to those sort of people, and to say, like, "Listen, this is what it is. And if you truly are an old school gamer, it doesn't matter what stats for what game I gave you, you can play it in your game."
Interesting. Interesting. Interesting experience on that, actually. Interesting.
All right. Well, we're running up about on time here. Does anyone have some?
Oh my God, we are. Oh yeah. My God. That time flew by. I thought we were like 30 minutes into it. What the heck happened? I'm like, what?
Ian, is there anything, any final thoughts or anything that we didn't get to touch on that you'd like to talk about in regards to self-publishing?
I don't know. There's a lot. Like, you could, if you have questions and you're out there. So I myself attend TotalCon, GaryCon, GameholeCon, and North Texas. If you face now, feel free to walk up and introduce yourself, and I will share anything I have to share with you. Feel free to ask questions. Find us on Facebook, or find us on, you know, Instagram, Twitter, all the at social medias, and we'll respond to you. It's cool to hear about other people's projects and how excited they are about them.
We'll update our notes on this video, Ian, with all of your relevant links, so folks can find you on social media or find your products and whatnot. So. Look for that in the section below.
I can say that all three of us are going to be at TotalCon at the end of February. So look for any of the three of us Marlborough, right?
Yeah.
Marlborough, Massachusetts.
Mass.
When I
yeah. Yep.
So Paul moves Lattery there, Ian comes down, and I go up to Marlborough for TotalCon. And I will say, Ian, that I was looking at registering for your playtest events there, but both Paul and you both scheduled games in that early morning slot, both Saturday and Sunday. So I'm committed to running games with Paul those mornings. Otherwise, I would have joined in, actually.
That's a Sophie's choice of gaming events there. You gotta...
Yeah.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
My wife is actually playing in one of Paul's boss fights, which she's like, "Oh, it's just the boss fight? This sounds amazing. I don't want to do all that build-up stuff." I was like, "Oh, okay, this is the event for you. DM's good. You'll have a blast.
Yeah, those.
So I thought that was great.
Dan and I really, really enjoy those. they should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So the boss fights, I'm always the co-DM. So I'm the dedicated adversary. So I will be running the villain attempting to kill your wife.
That's, you have my blessing to do what you need to do. Despite our wizardry rivalry, which that was that last year or the year before at TotalCon? We did
that was just last year, yeah. That was just a year ago.
Dan and I in Tim DeShane's game, I could not cast a spell in DCC Lankmire to save my life, so I just started using my crossbow and screaming out in bolt.
Everybody at the table was just dying between the two of us, rivalry with the wizards. They were just dying.
Pretty hilarious to see two wizards trying to outdo each other when they're both actually quite terrible.
Oh yeah, it was that game was such a great time though. It was really a wonderful time.
Tim didn't know what hit him with that. It's like, is this actually a problem now or what?
That's it. And he's a great DM too. It's another TotalCon DM or other gaming conventions. Tim DeShane is wonderful. And he'll actually be helping someone produce a they're doing a zine. Oh, what is the name of it? I'm blanking on the name of it, but I will share that with you because it looks really, really neat.
I could almost remember. Right after we finish this stream, I'm going to remember it, like 30 seconds after we stop.
Right? It's that whole tip of the tongue thing. Like, as soon as it's off, you're like, oh, yeah.
Dan, any final thoughts or questions for us?
Thanks to Ian so much. I here's an index card that I've been keeping of like stuff that I just learned for me and myself that I'm going to have to take action on. So I think this has been like really invaluable. So thank you so much for joining us, Ian.
Well, it's funny. I'll see if I can twist Rocky's arm and you can get, and he'll say exactly the opposite of everything I said. He's baffled.
Excellent.
Perfect. We need to do that. That's awesome.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. And we're really looking forward to seeing you at TotalCon.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
So to all of our viewers, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle Wandering DMs.
Also, our show is available in audio-only podcast format. You can find that on iTunes or Google Podcasts or any place that serves podcasts. If you're listening to us on one of those channels, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate it.
And as always, thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And remember, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.